I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson.
And we are a Jew
and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah.
Well, welcome into our podcast. This is episode 44A. We'd rather not deal with 45.
Well, us in the free world.
Yeah. So this is a podcast where we struggle and wrestle with those deep, meaningful questions such as King David, Lanceros, or Bellicosas? Give that one a thought. We'd like to acknowledge our sponsors of A Jew and a Gentile, the podcast.
With the egg, because then you could chuck that at a giant, Philistine giant.
True, well, but he wasn't king at that point. I mean, when he was king, you know, being a warrior, would he smoke Lanceros or Bellicosas?
If you're a good one, you smoke everybody else's cigars.
Well, yeah, that goes without saying. And if they don't want to give it to you, you send them off to war. We acknowledge our sponsors before we get into much more trouble. Men of the Beard, Beard Oil.
I'm out. So if Mark's listening to this, you know,
Mark, can you send us some?
You know, I think
he's drinking it personally.
Yeah, he's not updated. It's
I think you're drinking your beard oil.
Well, it's hard not to when it's just that, you know, a mouthful of goose juice. Just
Yeah.
Or as it's known now, desire.
Desire.
But yeah, I'm out. In the other bottle, I got the chai.
Yeah.
Not even on the website. Which is credit to just how much of that stuff they're moving. I mean,
yeah. And it's good stuff. I mean, I've got an old gray beard, and it's nice and fluffy.
That's an awful thing to call your wife.
Oh, no, I don't. I call her Dr. Mrs. Jew. Virgil Caine Rye Whiskey is another one of her sponsors. I'm enjoying a nice, smooth glass of that at the moment. And, of course, our favorite place in the free world, the Pipe and Pint.
Oh, is that the one on Spring Garden in Greensboro?
It is indeed the one on Spring Garden in Greensboro, run by Larry Christopher and his helper, the Cigar Gnome, Pete Pike.
Cigar Gnome, except in December when he becomes the Cigar
Elf.
I guess it may be Halloween. No, that's Christmas.
That's
Krampus.
Christmas.
Krampus or Elf?
Yeah. That's another one of those deep questions we've been wrestling with on our podcast. So, Chris, you are not smoking a cigar, but you are smoking. Please share what it is.
I am, and it's harder than Chinese algebra for me. I was in Raleigh this week, right next to NC State, taking a course. NC State's produced such great alumni like myself and Manny Quesada. We were not in the same class.
You still aren't in the same class.
I went down the Pipes by George, which I just got why that's because the guy wasn't George. And got a McClellan Flake 40th Anniversary Limited Edition 10. And myself and Lee, firstborn, Dr. Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Is enjoying it as well. And it's kind of got a tangy, ripe, dark, fruity sort of taste, a lot of earth notes. And it's just a really good Virginia tobacco. Lee, you want to throw in any other adjectives, or just make shit up? That's all I just did.
He's just enjoying it.
I could add the word, and it has a nice drier lint hint to it. I mean, there's like literally seven people.
A little bounce to it. You bounce
a bounce to your step. I set you up for that.
Yeah. Well, you set me up with the flake comment because that's appropriate type of tobacco for you.
Well, tell me. You aren't the one at dinner telling you, well, before you can put that in your pipe, you got to rub one out.
That's right. That's a very important tip there for those of you using flake tobaccos. Before you stuff that pipe, make sure you rub one out.
Yeah, but you were saying that in the middle of church today.
Well, it wasn't mine, so.
My joke was not yours.
Not at all.
Charlie, I'm struggling with this thing.
Well, I mean, this is the first time you've picked up a pipe in what, 8 years? 9 years?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I can't.
But the pipe itself, you have to describe the pipe because that is a special
pipe. Another Pipe and Pint. You know, they actually sell pipes, as the name would imply.
And pints.
And pints and craft brews and wine. They have pretty much every vice that you can think of under one roof. And I'm going to have to ask you, because I cannot remember or pronounce correctly the name of the maker of this one. It's the Ligne Bretagne.
Ligne Bretagne.
Bretagne.
Yeah.
So a burl wood, smooth finish. But the neat thing is on the stem, there's a little band of teak. And my understanding is that Larry, down there at Pipe and Pint, had acquired some boards from the deck of the USS North Carolina, which is basically dry dock down in Wilmington, North Carolina. And trying to find something to do with that wood.
We're never going back into the Pipe and Pint now.
If you're playing the Jew and a Gentile home drinking game, every double entendre take a shot.
They'll never get through the open.
Well, yeah, but they'll enjoy the podcast, which is more than we say for most folks.
Yeah,
but no, he took the deck and had it repurposed, and it's decorates the stem to this really wonderful pipe that. Someday, you know, I'll learn how to keep lit for more than a second. So Charles, what I should have done was smoke a cigar and just. But you know, I bought the pipe tobacco for us. You know, it's a little offering there.
Okay.
Well, Charles, what are you smoking?
I'm smoking and just into the Pipe and Pint. It's new this year from our friend AJ Fernandez, the Enclave Broadleaf.
AJ's done a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, and this is the broadleaf of the Enclave. Which I've had before. It's a really beautiful medium cigar. This one, what's interesting is he's using a Connecticut broadleaf that is also a Maduro. So it's been aged. It's a Connecticut broadleaf Maduro. So it's a nice dark wrapper, little toothy, but mainly just really nice smooth veins in it. Another interesting thing he does is the filler is Nicaraguan Pilato Cubano, but the binder is Nicaraguan-grown Cameroon.
Whoa. That, you know how much, this pipe tobacco is really good, but now you're just being a dick about it, really. You know, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That is a hybrid of...
Only A.J. Fernandez, and this actually was his father who suggested this blend. Of using the Cameroon as the binder and using the Connecticut broadleaf to make Maduro.
I have never heard of a Connecticut broadleaf Maduro.
Neither have I.
That just sounds like, for those that are uneducated, which, let's be fair, is everybody that was listening to this at this point, that's just not a word you associate with Connecticut tobacco. It's usually that, or one of those.
Sunshade.
Really, yeah.
Yeah, sunshade. Shade grown. Really light, delicate. So
it can have great flavor, and that's something I'm having to learn. Is I turn my nose up and go straight for the Maduro, the Habano, the Oscura. It's really good and dark, and well, once you go Maduro,
you never go back.
You can't go back.
Yeah. So it's got, as you would expect from these tobaccos, again, the earthy. Musky cedar, beautiful white pepper to it. Then as you get more into it, you get start picking up some coca, and it's almost like dark coffee, like espresso coffee in it, and the spice kind of backs off. Lot of smoke, well constructed, as you'd expect from AJ Fernandez. So it's I'm enjoying this. This is a really good smoke.
Yeah, this is picking up now. I think I've got it lit for at least a second. So
yeah,
I've forgotten how rich flavors that you can get out of pipe tobacco. And it's Lee was saying earlier, it's just a different kind of experience. I mean, I love the smell of cigars, but you can't put that. The aromatic quality of a good pipe tobacco is going to. People don't cross the street to avoid pipe smokers. Yeah. Well, I mean, depending on what kind of pipe you're smoking.
Who you are. Smoking a pipe, they'll walk across the street to avoid you. So, well, you were saying you were in Raleigh, and you're at a mindfulness seminar and had a very interesting experience there, I understand.
But you're going to have to narrow that down.
Well, first of all, one of the participants...
Oh yes, with sitting beside me.
Sitting beside you.
Yeah, that was such an asshole. But
I'm shocked to discover gambling going on in this establishment.
No, I mean, because mindfulness is a form of psychiatric intervention. It really grew out of Buddhism and Eastern religion type practices.
Primarily. Like Judaism.
Like Judaism. Well, I mean, Christianity has an Eastern branch.
Yeah.
And there are Christian writers in the, that have reclaimed some of those Eastern traditions. Richard Rohr, very popular. Mm-hmm. Of course, Thomas Merton would be in there
absolutely.
As well. But it's a way of being present, grounded. It's a way of taking your mind and focusing and repetition, because whatever you pay attention to and repeat is what's going to become habit. So it's more than just, you know, think happy thoughts, although that's part of it, but there's an intentionality behind it. All that to say that, you know, the person that gave the presentation was gave fair credit to religion as being, you know, psych stole that from us. You know, that's just all there is to it. And beside me, there's this lady kvetching and just going on about how religion has no place in this, yada, yada, yada. And she just goes, and I'm of course, doing what I do best, which is just letting her sink both feet into her mouth. And, you know, kind of going around the room, like, you know, how many of you here are LPCs? How many of you are MSWs, et cetera, et cetera? Then, you know, there was a few of us that didn't fit any of those broad categories. So she introduced herself as a rec therapist.
Was that rec or rectal?
Well, she had her head up there, so there's a good chance she could do both. But she's a rec therapist, and I waited, and I said, oh, well, I'm a chaplain. Well, you start classes next week.
I start classes next week, yeah. I'm actually going to do stuff. People are going to pay me. That's really scary.
To show up, to pay you to show up, usually.
They'll pay me to leave. Yeah.
All right, I have not figured out the witchcraft that has to exist to make this damn thing stay lit. So I'm tagging out. Is there a cigar in the house?
Yeah, I think we've got a couple. Lee's grabbing the humidor. You want a La Colonia? You want a?
At this point,
you want one of these enclaves? I got another enclave.
Yeah. If you can part with it.
Yeah, well, for you.
I tried. I thought of you guys when I was in the pipe shop. And I was going like, well, you know, if I don't enjoy this, and I've got pipes, got some good ones. And I was like, well, I know that Charles, and now that Lee's in the room, I have to say that I was thinking about him, too, even though
you weren't.
You are, isn't. He doesn't really come to mind. Unless you're trying not to think about Lee, then that's the only thing you can be mindful of.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, look at that.
Yeah.
That was mindfulness.
Wow.
On display. Right there.
And Lee is present.
He is present. He's very grounded, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's chaired, actually.
He's chaired.
Yeah. No. Well,
so we've dispensed with some of the lightheartedness because obviously with this past weekend.
Yeah, there's some things to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as we posted on our Twitter.
Do your thoughts and prayers go out to folks in Las Vegas?
They do, but as we posted, just absolutely no words.
No, there's not.
There's not, but we're going to come up with some.
Yeah.
Not so much on the particular event, but just the continuing, some people call it rhetoric, and professionally I would call it a rhetoric, but since I'm not being paid, I'll just call it bullshit, that goes on around these kinds of incidents. The first is got to be the thoughts and prayers. And then the total inaction and refusal, this is not the time, coming from our supposed leaders, our elected officials, trying to do anything.
It's coming from the polis as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. It's coming from the people who can do something about this.
Yeah, but it's also being said and carried forward by people that voted for those folks.
Yeah, and it's, you know, again, as we posted, I go to Hillel. You know, if not now, when?
Yeah. What is an acceptable death toll before we say, you know, maybe?
Right. Or how long do we have to wait before we have the debate? You know, how many days? Don't tell me that. If this is not the time, seriously, when is? Is it next week? That we can then discuss this? Does it depend on body count? Like, the more people who are killed, the longer we have to wait before we can discuss this?
Well, it's 243 days into the year, and it's the 244th mass shooting, according to Deadspin and several other
Yeah, so obviously this is not the time then, because...
Well, you know, so we should probably just go back to talking about pipes and cigars.
Yeah.
I mean, something we know about, because, you know, let's be fair, cigars have never killed anybody.
No.
Alcohol never killed anybody.
And we just certainly don't regulate it.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be stupid. That'd be like asking people for an ID and phone number, birthday, mm-hmm. social security number to buy Sudafed. Sudafed.
Well, you got to keep them.
Keep that out. Cause,
yeah, because that means, I mean, let's face it, they got a head cold.
Yeah. And if you outlaw Sudafed, then only outlaws will be able to get rid of head colds.
Yeah. Well, then, but it's easier to identify them because they'll be the only healthy people.
Right?
Yeah. But, you know, this is not the time. And the other part of it that is, well, you know, there is no amount of regulation that's going to prevent these kinds of things from happening. And that's true, too. But certainly there are things that we can do to lessen the frequency of them and to lessen the toll. When people say, well, you know, if you had a knife, you still would have killed people. Yeah, but not 60 of them in 10 minutes. Well, if you'd driven a truck through, yeah, but not 60 of them in 10 minutes. You know, from the time he started firing to the time he stopped, 10 minutes, 400 people wounded, 59 people dead. There is no other weapon besides explosives or no other device that could be used as a weapon that would have happened, that you would have had that death toll. So, yeah, you can't legislate out crazy. You can't stop crazy. You can't stop these people from doing things. Yeah, but you can minimize the effect. You can make it harder for them to get the implements that they used. You can, you know, reduce the number of people at risk because, again, you know, there is nothing that, you know, I've never heard of a semi-automatic knife.
No, but if there was a particular, you know, it just, I am at a loss of words still with, you know, my own kid going with the wife to a concert tonight in Charlotte, and she asked, like, am I going to be safe?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, reassured her that, I did reassure her, but honestly, in the saying, I was like, you know, I get her question.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't want her to grow up in a world of fear. I mean, I've gone 41 years and have never needed a firearm to solve a problem or to protect myself. And I'm not going to buy into the myth that one has to. You know, if you want to own one, that's your business. But the fact that I don't, and I would really rather people that can't be responsible with them don't have access to them. You know, I know we're going to get into the topic of... Well, the gentleman was clearly mentally ill.
Right, which is the other rhetoric, yeah.
But, you know, the arguments of, well, guns don't kill people. People kill people. Or if you outlaw guns, the only people who have guns are outlaws. Having lived in other countries, they look at us like, you know, what do you symbol? What do you associate America with? Violence. Yeah. Guns. I mean, we have perfected violence.
Yeah.
Well, we are the major exporters of the myth of redemptive violence.
Yeah, or just violence. Or
preventative violence.
You know, well, just violence as the solution to the problem. Regardless of the problem, it can be solved with violence.
But that's sort of working off the moronic axiom of, well, if you only have a hammer in your toolbox, everything looks like a nail.
Right. And if that's the only coping mechanism you've ever learned, regardless of the situation, you're going to do it. In fact, one of the few highly correlative factors in almost every single mass shooting case is some form of domestic violence.
I don't doubt it.
You know, yes, this gentleman did not have a police record of domestic violence, but it has been reported that he was verbally abusive to his girlfriend on many occasions. Again, it's, you know, that, you know, this culture of violence as being acceptable.
So how much of it? Because, I mean, we've talked about right and left, conservative, progressive, et cetera, and the need to cross lines. How much of this do you think is really if people that are pro gun, just to use a general term, is it just the feeling that, well, if we back down, our side loses, versus, you know what, maybe we got this wrong, and there's a way to coax people out of those defensive postures, which the words escape me, but in a way that lets them kind of put down their guns, that this is not the answer. Clearly, it's not the answer.
Yeah. Well, I think part of what's creating that situation where it seems like we can't have a discussion because it's always that knee-jerk, well, you're just trying to take my gun away, is that's how the NRA has been framing this for decades.
Well, they're even coming out for them.
But it's important to remember that the NRA as a lobby does not represent gun owners. They represent gun manufacturers.
Yeah.
So they have a vested interest in people wanting to own firearms.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, they're the ones who stoke the fear of, well, they're coming for your guns. Yeah. And again, we could pick a time and we could have the debate, they would hear that no one is proposing that.
Well,
guns don't kill people, people kill people. Yes. And we're trying to make sure that if they decide to do that, they're going to do it with a less deadly weapon.
Put those fuckers.
Or keep the gun out of their hands.
Put those lobbyists, those hardliners and stuff. It's like, you know what? You can have that position. But you're going to spend the next mass shooting, you're going to work the ED cleaning up after it. Yeah, because, you know, clearly no gun did that. So why should you feel any responsibility? And I mean, I grew up in a violent home. My dad had guns. He, in a manner of speaking, although this is really being charitable, as a law enforcement officer, actually could justify needing those guns. But long after he had retired, I mean, he's basically one of those doomsday preppers. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is, and maybe this segues into mental health, but this is not a healthy position to live from. I mean, having grown up with it and having seen it, I still don't understand. And I was at eyeball to eyeball level with it.
Yeah, and I've done target shooting. I've gone hunting. I have friends who hunt, and most of them would tell you that if you need a semi-automatic weapon to bring down a deer or a turkey, you shouldn't be hunting.
Is there one big deer out there with like a flak jacket and a grenade launcher? Is like, fuck you, Bambi, you know?
Yeah, and in most people's imagination, it's wearing a hijab or a keffiyeh, which is another element
yes,
to this.
He's mentally ill because he's white and male.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, because I think that, and we talked about that over dinner tonight, was is that a reaction towards distancing the perpetrator from normal people or people.
Right.
And your son brought up a great point, which was violence isn't
a sign of mental instability.
No, but you were saying it's not an aberration.
It's not an aberration. Yeah. It's the human condition.
Setting.
Yeah. Look at history.
Well,
that's what I'm saying. It gets back to this. This is how, you know, we are as human beings, you know, for a lot of people. I'm not just saying this in America, but for a lot of human beings, violence is seen as a plausible, acceptable solution to a situation. For some people, it is a default and it's the first thing they go to. Other people, it's more of a last resort.
Do you think that this, I mean, you worked in education and also parenting. You know when you say to kids, use your words?
Mm-hmm.
You think this is just a failure at a epic level to not put any other tool in the toolbox but the hammer, which happens to hit the back of a round and shoot a projectile, because that's all the guns do is they just launch projectiles.
To take this out of the gun debate and keep it in the violence debate, look at the statistics of domestic violence, and they will show that almost every person who has been arrested or, you know, at least, you know, police been called for domestic abuse was themselves abused at some point in their life. And so, the lesson to that is violence is acceptable.
So the first thing my mind flashes back to what Lee had said, that it's not the aberration, it's the default setting is. Mm-hmm. So now I'm wondering, is violence a learned behavior?
Well, I don't think violence is not the learned behavior. I think that what's learned is the acceptance of violence as one of the first go-tos.
Well, and it just never makes, I mean, the people rate, well, you know, that's making a generalization, and it's going back to drawing lines, and I really, you know, I knew this was going to be the topic this week. I mean, it has to be.
It's
people of faith, it's folks that have deal with and live with mental illness, and mm-hmm. as parents, as, I mean, there's pretty much every way that we're in the room identity-wise that this hits a nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And I just mm-hmm. keep that image of, is it just like you can't let go that, you know what, this is out of control, that ratcheting up, because for one side to ratchet up, the other side's got to be ratcheting up as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think we go back to what you're saying about just the distancing. It's scary to deal with because we have, even if you have never done this, you do have to face the fact that it is still part of who you are as a human being, and the potential is there. Right. But we always talk about that's what separates us, though, from the quote-unquote lower animals, is we're supposed to be able to control those impulses and instincts. And if we're going to put it into the faith-based discussion, one of the things about Judaism as a faith is it's extraordinarily counterintuitive. It's designed to make you work against every single natural instinct you have. When we talk about in Judaism that you have, you know, as you see on TV in a Christian world, you know, the devil on one shoulder and the angel on another arguing, we talk about the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov, the good voice and the evil voice whispering into your ear about, you know, what to do in a situation. And for many of the rabbis, for them, it's not one is good and one is evil. It's the good voice is your intellect and your humanity, and the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, is your animal instincts. And Judaism is designed to acknowledge that inclination to just knee-jerk react as you would to any other stimulus as if you were in a Skinner box is to say, no, I'm going to rationally think about this and not press that button because I'm not hungry right now.
So here's my curveball,
mm-hmm.
and I'm leveling it not to reflect somewhere where I am personally, but a response from folks that would push back against that mm-hmm. that conceptualization of Judaism. Putting cities to the ban. Elijah slaughtering the prophets
mm-hmm.
of Baal.
Mm-hmm.
Common Christian argument, there's a shitload of violence.
There is a shitload of violence. And we were talking about that earlier, Lee and I, and we also last year when Shavuot was on, we were talking about that. Torah is not perfect and beautiful. Yeah. It does not present an ideal. It presents humanity. And it forces us to face and come to terms with those elements in life that are messy and are terrible and deal with them. So, yes, it represents those things. It presents those things. But in most cases, if you read the rest of the text, it's not always a good outcome.
Well,
and the love and mercy is always stressed. But it's there to make us uncomfortable. It's there to, we are supposed to read those passages and be shocked. just as we hear what happened in Vegas and be shocked and then do something to prevent it.
Which is would be to do mitzvah.
Or to do teshuvah, you know, to do repentance or return. So the counter to your argument is, well, yes, we acknowledge those things are there, but that's because we're not going to pretend like those things can never happen.
Well, and for, to be fair, presenting that more as a
no, because we hear that that is used all the time, and in fact, it's used as one of the reasons to expunge Judaism from Christianity and to retranslate our Torah into the Old Testament and discount the God of creation.
Well, and it's in my response, you know, when I've read and even when I was learning Hebrew scriptures in divinity school, was that oftentimes you have very human writers.
Exactly.
And that where some people would read as being violence is ordained, violence is permitted, violence is glorified, that more often than not, my encounters with the Hebrew scriptures, this is violence being chronicled.
Exactly.
It's a history.
Yes. Right.
And it's not trying to say this history means it's okay, it just means it happened.
Right.
And because the much tidier thing to be... I just sit here thinking, Charles, and I'm like, okay, so the same people, or I'd imagine the same people that would say, well, look, you know, David was a great conquering warlord and wanted to sort of bring those passages out. It just occurred to me that they're also the last people that want to say, well, what if Christ was crucified being a political insurgent against the establishment? Oh, no. The violent shit stops right before Matthew's gospel.
Right.
Or somewhere right before Paul wrote his first letter. No.
Well, and as most Jewish scholars and rabbis will admit, David and his family is the epitome of the dysfunctional family.
Oh, and David wasn't spared judgment.
No, there's a reason why he was not allowed to build God's temple. and that's the truth. And that, you know, there are many, many, many Jews who will agree to that. And, you know, that's what I'm saying. But if you look at, you know, the mitzvot, they're all, like the whole thing with loving the stranger, that is so counterintuitive to say you have to be respectful of the person who is different than you. Because the instinct for humanity is always to separate and to fear the person who's not a member of your tribe. Yeah, that's human instinct.
That counterintuitiveness becomes Constantinianized with Christianity.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, that doesn't really function for the dominant narrative in our culture, so let's do what Christianity, and I will say this, has done and done well throughout its history, and sometimes in a positive sense, like Celtic Christianity, but as we adapt to the point that we no longer really are what we were to start with, we're just a manifestation that helps that which is in power stay in power.
Yeah.
There's a reason why the Pax Romana was don't mess with their religion. Don't give them any reason.
Yeah.
So the Pax Romana versus, you know, Jesus, you know, because another character within there is the Iscariot. In the broader sense, which is likely a personified scapegoat of Judaism, Judas, whether he actually existed or not. But the Iscariot were rebels. They were,
yes, they were.
Violent insurgents.
Yes, they were. They were some pretty scary dudes.
So even if now you've got to kind of justify that, that's maybe opening up the proverbial can of worms we don't have enough space for tonight, but and this was people brought into the inner circle of the 12, which is I'm kind of jumping back and forth across an interpretation of Judas, but I never really thought of that till now. It's just, wait a minute, you know, starting at the second half of the Bible, as it were. I don't know. That's an old. God's had kids. He's mellowed, which is going back to the Marcion heresy. Which we've detailed with our podcast with Russ and
Kristen.
For Love in a Dangerous Time. So segue, not really segue, because we've already mentioned it, but the distancing by saying, well, this is somebody that's mentally ill, and the violence that does to those living with mental illnesses.
Yes.
And Lee's in the room. I've got to be nice to him. Who knows? He may be violent. I mean,
he is related to me.
I don't know, how many did you kill on top of Mount Carmel?
Well, as we were saying,
but the wisdom.
We can throw this out to you. It's like, gosh, one Jew dies, and the Christians have gone crazy for 2,000 years, obsessing over
right.
it.
You know? Just not the other million.
Yeah, right. But just this one Jew. Yeah. And you guys just can't let it go.
Let it go. But the mental his point was, and it's something I would hope our listeners are aware of, or they will be when I get done talking, is that yes, there is definitely a significant number of people that commit violent acts that certainly could be diagnosed with a mental illness. But that's got to be weighed against, for instance, the 1 in 4 people will endure a diagnosable mental illness in their life. Depression, bipolar, schizophrenia probably being the leads, and I would think in that order. So if that were true, we would have a shitload more violence. And the reality is, and you know, Lee was wise to point it out, because it's truth, is that most mentally ill people are more likely to be victims of crimes and violence or self-harm. I mean, as a recovering depressive, we're not a motivated crowd to hurt people.
No.
I mean, just, you know, we're not.
Well, and the wanting to separate is, I think, goes back to my statement about Judaism being counterintuitive. It's, we want to believe that we are supremely rational beings. And what occurred in Las Vegas was not the act of a rational person.
No.
But lack of rationality is not the same as presence of mental illness.
No.
But we need to make it that way so that we can excuse ourselves and say, well, you know, this person's an aberration. This person isn't like me. There's nothing in me that would lead me to do these things. When the truth is, we are anything but rational creatures. We are much more controlled by emotion than we care to admit. Most recent election as example.
Okay, now I'm wanting to get into being created in the image of God, and if our default setting is violence. Oh, I think that's where I'm kind of like, I agree with Richard Rohr in his take in Breathing Underwater, Spirituality in the 12 Steps, is that his interpretation, I'm thinking like, this is brilliant. Original sin isn't some kind of Augustinian fiction. Yeah, I said that. What's he going to do, kick my ass? I mean, you know. Do you know what Augustine would be doing right now if he were alive? Scratching at the lid of his coffin. But, no, he points out that the original sin is the nature and nurture that the image of God is born into. It's not some kind of, you know, Adam screwed up, so now we got to pay the price, which I always, and I will border on heresy there with my colleagues in ministry. But that I can actually see. And I think we're talking about mental illness, we're talking about violence. Somebody that works with substance abuse disorder, violence is an addictive substance. I mean, I know, like, growing up in that environment, you know, the violent alcoholic father, prone to, I mean, I've been shot by him. You know, he missed. Mm-hmm. If there was a night for him to be drunk, that was the one. But it's, and had every reason to take up and be violent. It was really an effort. I mean, my faith, one of the earliest expressions of it in what would now be middle school, junior high for me, was, I didn't have the words for it till I was much older, but pacifism. It was not just, it was sort of, it was that teen angst of, I don't want to be like my dad. Some of it was faith, and like, you know, I'm not reconciling this with what I'm reading in Sunday school. Notice I'm saying what I read, not what was taught.
Yeah.
Because I got my ass handed to
me. Yeah, because those are two different things.
I got my ass handed to me by one Sunday school teacher when I, you know, said like, you know, well, if it was broccoli that was the major export of Kuwait, we wouldn't be there. And he sent me to the pastor's office, who sent me back going, I'd like to hear the answer. Love that pastor. God bless him. But yeah, it, The big kind of disclaimer there is, remember, despite what you hear in the headlines, that, again, mentally ill people, I work with them literally 8 hours a day. I have, and this is on an inpatient unit at a trauma hospital, no violence like that. Although, what was the bit of legislation where the mentally ill should be allowed?
Yes.
And then we could also throw out there just for
discussion. Which 45 overturned the executive order on that.
Then the wanting to allow people to carry firearms into church.
Mm.
Now, that's one where, if I have colleagues that are serving a church and said, well, it's their right, I would really just take the stole off and defrock yourself. Mm. Because you are now a part of the machine. You're no longer... You are no longer living and ministering counterintuitively. Mm.
Yeah. And if you do want to go to the constitutional road, we regulate and put limits on every other right in the Constitution. And the amendment says well-regulated militia. So that means regulation.
Well, and there's no way, and I know that's part of the rhetoric, that founding fathers, as it were, had any inkling of 58 kills in less than 10 minutes with 500 plus wounded.
Yeah, their fear was a standing army, because in their experience and what they looked at in Europe is when governments had standing armies, they tended to turn them against their own people.
What is it? Which vendetta, the government should fear the people?
Yeah, not the other way around. And ironically, Washington turned the National Army against his own people, but fortunately that turned out okay. Otherwise we wouldn't be drinking Virgil Caine right now. That's a historical reference to the Whiskey Rebellion. For those of you who weren't sure what I was talking about, you can Google it if you want.
It was a Joan Baez song or the band.
No, that's the night they drove. No, Washington was before the Civil War.
Oh, well, that's going to be news for some of our listeners.
Yeah, not a lot of people know that. And I've been hearing good things about this Washington guy. I think you're going to be hearing good things about him. The teeth was fake news.
I hear. Yeah, and throwing a dollar across. You're right.
Well, that was propaganda.
Well, the cherry tree.
The cherry tree was also propaganda.
We're joking because I think this topic we just have.
You have to.
Breath. But there is that. This is the same kind of rhetoric. It's the same kind of mystifying and making legendary, and the word is escaping me. Mythologizing.
Yeah.
That
exactly
we do at a more, actually I don't think it's subtle, but
we've made the myth of the gun,
redemptive violence,
or just the gun in general in our society.
Well, in the philosophical argument, guns don't kill people, but this was not a device. Yes, could kill people, but it wasn't designed to kill people.
Right. There are a lot of things that can be used to kill people, but that is not their original intent or design. The gun was designed specifically to kill. That's its sole purpose.
Yeah.
It's been adapted to be used for sports shooting and target shooting, but in the 15th century, when it was invented, as a weapon of war designed to kill people.
Well, and we were talking about earlier, the NRA doing the wanting to regulate bump stocks, which for those that don't know what that phrase is, those are the devices that you can buy that can take a semi-automatic weapon and essentially make it an automatic weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's we need to outlaw this. So here's my question, and you know where I'm going with this. These things are sold quite readily at gun shows.
Yeah,
that are complete Wild West, unregulated. And I can say this again from the culture I grew up in, was that, my dad would take me to gun shows as a small kid, which was hell for me because it was just a long day of looking at guns. But, he'd say, well, okay, I'm going to give you this much money. Go buy this from this dealer if he comes down on his price. And these were, apparently, responsible adults selling, a firearm to my dad, but giving it to the kid to walk it all the way across the convention center and maybe hands it to his dad.
Yeah.
So they don't hit me with this, that there's a more responsible generation or some nonsense. Mm-hmm. Just admit that, you know, the first step of dealing with an addiction is...
admit you have a problem.
Followed by surrendering that to a higher power as you know it.
Yeah, too bad we don't live in a country that has any faith-based belief in a higher power.
Right, right. Well, they do. It's just almighty dollar.
Yeah. Well,
this is a black hole.
Yeah, and we can keep going down it, but I don't know if it's going to do us any good. We feel better a little bit talking about these things.
Well, we do, and it's because being silent only keeps the myth of redemptive violence out there, the myth of the gun, the unfair stigmatizing of the mentally ill. I guess now it's bad enough that Monty Hall died this past week.
Yeah, member of the tribe, by the way.
Well, let's make a deal. Well, of course he's Jewish. Let's make a deal.
Tom Petty.
Free falling, man. It's been.
I started listening to Tom Petty when I was in high school. That's when his first album came out.
Well, to reference one of his early videos in the 80s, we are definitely in a rabbit hole. Down the rabbit hole, this one.
Oh, yeah.
I know we make that reference because it's just taking a breath from what is otherwise a suffocating reality at present.
Mm. And just looking at the news and things like that, you definitely feel like we're through the looking glass.
Oh, we're free falling for certain.
Yeah. Well, I do have some words of wisdom to close, and they come from Tom Petty.
I was hoping that was going to be the case. Yeah. Pause and edit and make you sound brilliant for putting a Tom Petty quote in there. Don't come around here no more.
No. I just tell you that every time you leave. I have one, and it's actually not a song lyric. It's actually something he said in an interview. He said, "I don't understand the ones that have no sense of hope and invest in hate. That's not going to work out, you know. It's a waste of your time."
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
And we invite you to join us next time when a Jew and a Gentile
walk into a bar mitzvah.
I've been kicking myself over things.